At Alma, we know the connection between you and your therapist matters. But if you're already feeling stressed and burnt out, the idea of trying to find a therapist you really connect with can be overwhelming. That's why Alma's focused on helping you find the right therapist for you. When you browse their online directory, you can filter by the qualities that are most important to you. Then, book free 15-minute consultations with any therapist you're interested in seeing. And because 95% of therapists at Alma accept insurance, you can find care that's affordable too. You want to talk to someone, but not just anyone. Alma is there to help you find the right fit. Visit helloalma.com/therapy30 to schedule a free consultation today. That's helloalma.com/therapy30.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the pod of thunder and rock and roll, and I am back from Japan. Amazing experience, Tokyo Dome, Wrestle Kingdom 13. What a war I had with Naito. I promised it would be definitely a match that you should go out of your way to check out, as well as Tanahashi versus Kenny Omega. Two great matches, if I don't mind myself saying, to finish out the Tokyo Dome show, and it's just a great experience. I love the Dome. I love Tokyo. I love Japan. I love New Japan. So I look forward to working there more in the future. Nothing booked as of right now, but hopefully we will have some good times coming. So great to hear all the amazing feedback from the Tokyo Dome, and great pictures up on Instagram if you want to go check them out at Chris Jericho Fozzy. And we got lots to talk about today. Something I've been really interested in, Making a Murderer, which is a Netflix series. If you haven't seen it, you might not understand what's going on this show. If you have seen it, you know just all the chicanery and the strange situations surrounding Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey. Were they framed? Seems like they were. Did they really murder Teresa Halbach? I mean, many believe they were wrongfully convicted and set up by a corrupt sheriff's department in Manawatu County, Wisconsin. Season one was a few years ago. Season two just released, and the series continues by detailing the ongoing fight to get them both released from jail and their convictions overturned, and the fight being spearheaded by Chicago attorney Kathleen Zellner. And today, I've got author and journalist John Farrick here on the show. John was part of USA Today's Wisconsin investigative team in 2016 and 17, and wrote many in-depth articles about the Stephen Avery, Brandon Dassey case. Kathleen Zellner has also given him exclusive access to a lot of the information and investigations that she and her team have uncovered and done on behalf of Avery. So John took his years of coverage of the case and wrote a book called Wrecking Crew, Demolishing the Case Against Stephen Avery, which focuses on Zellner's quest to get Avery's conviction overturned and get him released from jail, and hopefully Brandon Dassey as well. Book came out just before Christmas, and John's on the show today to talk about the incredible case and why he's so certain Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey are both innocent of Teresa Halbach's murder and should be freed from prison. He also lays out everything Zellner and her law firm have been doing, and John shares an alternate theory of Teresa's murder, which Zellner and her team are pursuing, and names a couple of other suspects that may be the real killers, talking about all the planted evidence, all the coincidences and cliches behind the case. And he's also going to update what's been happening with the case since filming ended on the second season of Making a Murder on Netflix. So here we go, talking all about Stephen Avery, Brendan Dassey, Kathleen Zellner. It's John Farrick here, Making a Murderer Exposed, right here on Talk is Jericho. All right, so Making a Murderer Season 2, I just finished watching it. It's sweeping the nation just like Making a Murderer 1 did. And I have John Farrick with me here, who wrote a great new book called Wrecking Crew, which is basically the whole story all the way up to where we are right now. And John, first of all, like you said, this book that you wrote is basically geared for people who have seen the show and familiar with the show. And I believe, what did you say it was, about 40 million people have watched the series since it debuted?
Yeah, I was going to say, I've heard numbers around that that range, Chris. When you consider the first, the original Making a Murder was just such an unbelievable hit, took the world by surprise. And then you've had so many people that are newbies too, that for whatever reason didn't see the original Making a Murder when it came out, or they were in college or high school or whatever, you know, or grown up now. But there's so many people that have latched on to the second series, which I really thought was really well done, and does a great job of going in a completely different direction than the first series, which I thought was magnificent to begin with.
Yeah, and I know you've written books on subjects of this matter in the past, you know, wrongful convictions and true crime and that sort of thing. What was it about Making a Murder that drew you to wanting to write Wrecking Crew, a book all about it?
That was a little interesting, too, from the standpoint that by that point in my life, I was actually back in Wisconsin. I worked there two different times in my life. At that point in time, I was working for Gannett in the USA Today network. So I was an investigative journalist up in Wisconsin at the time that Making a Murder came out. And we were all kind of surprised and just stunned at the worldwide acclaim that this was getting just within a matter of days of it coming out. And I was fortunate that I had a really good editor at that point in time that was around when the original trial happened for Steve Avery and Brendan Dassey, Chris, and he basically gave me the thumbs up as a reporter to go out and do as many investigative pieces for the USA Today network as I could. So I, over the last year and a half, in 2016, 2017, I wrote a ton of in-depth articles, just really looking at the Manitowoc County Sheriff's Office, looking at the prosecutor in the case, just looking at different pieces of evidence and the whole fairness concept of criminal justice for Brendan and Steve Avery. And so just from working on so many of those stories, I realized at some point in time, it would be worthwhile to do a book. But I wanted to do a book that was different than, because there was two or three that came out immediately after Making a Murder, and a couple of them were written by prosecutors that were involved in the case. So I wanted to put together, at some point in time, when I put together a book, I wanted it to be different. I wanted it to be from a standpoint of, looking at the criminal justice system and Manitowoc County, really with a tough eye, really a tough look at this case, because there's so many aspects of the case, as you probably know too, Chris, that just don't smell right, and just don't seem fair, regardless of guilt or innocence in the case.
Well, let's just give a quick background for people that might not have seen it, just kind of taking us up to snuff. I mean, tell the basic Crib Notes version of Steve Avery's story.
Sure. The Steve Avery, he was born in Manitowoc County, not born on a junkyard, but he was born into a family that owned a massive junkyard of about 40 acres of land that has thousands of wrecked and abandoned vehicles out there. And when Steve was in his early 20s, he was, as I've told people, he was kind of a rascal. He got involved in petty crime and just goofy stuff, from hanging around the wrong crowd of people and stuff like that, but nothing of any serious or violent nature as far as that goes. But anyway, in his early 20s, there was a young woman that was a businesswoman in Manitowoc that went for a jog along the Lake Michigan, and she was violently attacked, beaten, nearly killed, and raped along the shoreline. And within a matter of hours, the sheriff of that county took it upon himself to put himself in charge of the investigation, and basically railroaded Steve Avery and decided that, this was a high profile case. The family, was begging the police to solve it. And just within a matter of hours, he decided that Steve Avery was going to be guilty of this crime. So long and short, Steve Avery gets arrested. He goes to prison, and he sits in prison for 18 years for a crime that he didn't commit. And meanwhile, the real rapist, a serial predator named Gregory Allen, was able to get away with the crime, and the guy goes on to commit other rapes and eventually is in prison at the time that it's learned that Steve Avery was innocent of this crime. So it was a big deal in Wisconsin when Steve Avery was let out of prison in 2003. He's moving forward then after that. He gets some really good lawyers out of Milwaukee. He files a lawsuit against the sheriff's office for misconduct, and it's a $36 million lawsuit, and it's got a real good chance of either succeeding or ending up with a really nice settlement and stuff like that.
Yeah, $36 million, right?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, and like I said, at that point in time, it's 2005. We're 2 years into this case since Steve Avery's been out of prison, and Teresa Halbach, a photographer that worked for Auto Trader magazine, she disappears, and Steve Avery becomes the immediate prime suspect to the Manitowoc County Sheriff's Office, and within a matter of days, he gets arrested and charged with her murder.
Well, there's so many things to talk about here, because if you watch the series and read the book, it seems, you know, Stephen Avery with the worst luck ever. And if you're going by what the series says, and this is what I want to talk to you about as well, about the two sides of the coin, he was put in jail for 18 years unjustly for the rape of the lady, the candy store lady on the shoreline of the lake, because they wanted to get a quick conviction. They didn't listen to the evidence. They just put Stephen Avery away because, like you said, he was kind of a local ne'er-do-well rascal. Then as soon as he gets out, he's about to get a $36 million settlement from the state, and the insurance company has refused to insure the state on this claim. So right when he's about to get this gigantic statement, suddenly Teresa Halbach goes missing, and they pin it on Stephen Avery. And it seems like it's just evidence after evidence after evidence for Stephen Avery's innocence that the state and the county are just sweeping under the carpet, almost like they have a vendetta against Stephen Avery for all these different reasons.
Right. It just really seems unfair as far as the standpoint that you had the Manitowoc County Sheriff's Office thrust themselves, you know, into the case, you know, when several individuals in that department were already under scrutiny and had been given testimony. They were really kind of put through the ringer as far as with Steve Avery's lawsuit. And then rather than bow out or stay away from the case like most good police officers and departments would do, it's the opposite in this case. These guys are volunteering for the assignments to lead the searches on Steve Avery's house, his trailer, I should say. And then, you know, they're lying to the press. They're telling the local reporters that the Manitowoc County Sheriff's Office isn't really involved in the case except for, you know, getting pieces of heavy equipment, which was complete BS. So the whole thing really stunk to high heaven. And you had three different agencies involved in this stench, Chris. You had the Manitowoc County Sheriff's Office, which was responsible for Steve Avery's original wrongful conviction. And then you had the neighboring county, which is a similar smaller agency called Calumet County. And those two departments are kind of joined at the hip, Calumet and Manitowoc County. So it's important for people to know that. And then you had the state of Wisconsin's agency called the Department of Justice or their DCI. But basically these are state of Wisconsin special agents that were also involved in overseeing and making decisions as far as with the investigation and, collection of evidence and stuff like that.
So in Make Your Murder Season 2, Steven's still in jail. And also we got to talk about Brendan Dassey, who is his nephew that was implicated on a confession as a 16-year-old with a low IQ that he was kind of railroaded into, in my opinion. And it's the only evidence against Brendan Dassey in the murder of Teresa Halbach that he gave this confession. A tainted confession, and he's still in jail right now for life. It's been 12 years. And so then Catherine Zellner gets involved to sort of take up Stephen Avery's case. Now, explain who Catherine Zellner is.
Yeah, so Kathleen Zellner, she's out of the Chicago area, and she's a longtime attorney that's pretty well known, or has been well known around the Chicago area, but probably wasn't as well known nationally or internationally until season two of Making a Murder. But she's a lawyer that has decided just on her own over the last 20 or so years to really make her law firm focused on examining wrongful conviction cases and people that may be sitting in prison for a crime that they didn't commit. So it's a very small law firm. Her other people are you know, really busy with, you know, medical malpractice cases and, you know, other things to kind of help, you know, raise money and, you know, pay for the lights and electricity. But Zellner has really made it a crusade that she's going to try to help people that are sitting in prison for crimes they didn't commit and get them out and vindicate them. So she becomes interested in Steve Avery's plight really after Making a Murderer Part One came out in December 2015. And she decided that she was going to take on Steve Avery's case, his post-conviction, from that point forward. And she has spent, Chris, I think hundreds of thousands of dollars of her own, you know, money from her law firm to, you know, to hire experts, to, you know, to travel, to do legal research. But it's all money that that she's ponied up herself, just because she believes so strongly that Steve Avery is innocent, as well as Brendan Dassey. Now, Brendan obviously has a different set of attorneys, and he's been represented very well, I might add, by Laura Nyreiter and Steve Drizin out of Chicago at the Northwestern University Center for Wrongful Convictions. And they've done just such a tremendous job, you know, being in his corner when nobody else really was. And actually, I was at the prison in Portage, Wisconsin, at the end of 2016. We were all there, as far as us, you know, reporter types, because you know, that was the day that Brendan was supposed to get out of prison, because a federal judge in 2016 had issued I think it was 88 pages or so, but a very long, you know, long, well researched legal opinion that had basically overturned Brendan's conviction on the grounds that his confession was coerced and, you know, was inaccurate. And so while we were waiting for Brendan to be released from prison, but what happens is the state of Wisconsin's attorney general, a guy named Brad Schimmel, who really hadn't been in office very long, it's kind of a suit. But anyway, Schimmel files a motion and was able to get the Brendan's release from prison stayed or blocked at that point in time. And then the case gets dragged on and on. It goes to the Court of Appeals out of Chicago. And again, there's a ruling in Brendan Dassey's favor. It's 2-1. There's one judge that was actually appointed by Obama, which kind of surprised me. But he was very critical and just it just really went along with the program as far as, you know, thinking this, you know, this case was legitimate against Brendan Dassey. So even though the ruling goes 2-1 in Brendan's favor, and again, you're thinking now he should be finally let out of prison, that didn't happen either. You know, this judge, they were able to convince the whole Court of Appeals out of Chicago to hear the case, which I think is called an en banc hearing, which is very, 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 very rare, I might add. And at that point in time, the case, you know, went back before seven justices, and the ruling eventually goes 4-3 against Brendan. So even though he won at two separate levels, you know, had two different sets of judges overturn his conviction and think that he'd go free or get a new trial, that didn't happen thanks to the state of Wisconsin. And it's just mind-boggling that there's just so much bureaucracy, Chris, if you think about it, as far as, I mean, why even have all these lower levels of courts if this thing is just going to get dragged out and nobody's going to follow another judge's ruling and stuff like that. It would be like, you know, baseball or football or pro wrestling for that matter, like having like five sets of referees and stuff like that, you know. Right. And nothing would ever get done, and it just blows me away that this kind of stuff actually happens on a regular basis.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Two questions. One, do you believe that Brendan and Stephen Avery are innocent?
With Brendan, I'm 100% sure that he's innocent. Because I don't see any scenario from, again, having 20 years experience in the field out covering these kinds of cases. I've never seen a murder happen the way it was described by the prosecution, that they portrayed it as, that this was a premeditated murder by Steve Avery, you know, that he was, a sexual monster and a deviant and was targeting Teresa Halbach. The likelihood, if that did happen, you're not going to have a scenario where he's, torturing her or cutting her up in his bedroom and hears a knock or a ring at his doorbell, and walks down the hallway, to see who it is and then lets the person in, and it's his nephew. That crimes never happen that way. So, right. So just from that standpoint alone, the fact that we all know that there was no physical evidence, no blood, no hair, no DNA, no trace evidence found in Stephen Avery's trailer. And it was such a small trailer, and Avery's not the kind of sophisticated guy that would have been able to clean that stuff up anyway. It never happens anyway, by the way. Mm-hmm. I've had other cases where people try to put white out over blood spatter, and you could still find it. So I just work off of the fact is there's no evidence that she was harmed inside Steve Avery's trailer. So I just don't see any scenario with Brendan Dassey. And getting back to Avery at this point in time, I don't see any I don't see anything that connects, him to the crime, because all the other crucial pieces of evidence, have really been smashed and, blown up by Zellner and her experts and stuff like that. So what are we left with? We're left with the possibility that Avery could have committed the crime. But if he did, it would have had to have happened under completely different circumstances and scenario than what was presented at trial. And then you get into the fact that some of her bones, were found out at the Corey property and in Bobby Dassey's burn barrel. In my mind, both of those facts and events really are to Steve Avery's advantage, as far as just showing that, it's really, really, really unlikely that he's the culprit that somehow, was out in the Corey, or out at, his nephew's, yard 60 yards right. away and stuff like that. So at this point in time, it looks very strong, that Steve Avery, was innocent and had nothing to do with the crime as well, I think.
So then the other question is why, because when you watch the show, when you read the book, there's just, like I said, evidence after evidence that either wasn't submitted, that's just completely ignored. I mean, it's hard to believe that there's a statewide, countywide conspiracy against this man. What is your opinion on why this is happening?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of it goes back to, going back to the 80s, which was pointed out in the original Making a Murderer, Steve Avery wasn't the best, best guy around. And there was that situation where he got so mad about some of the false rumors that were being spread around about him in town, when he was in his 20s, that he had that unloaded, and I point out unloaded, but he had that unloaded shotgun that he pointed at one of the sheriff's deputies' wives, and was just really angry at her, back in the 80s for spreading false rumors about him. So the fact that something like that would happen in a small town in a rural area like this, where everybody kind of knows everybody, and he and his family are kind of already written off, Chris, as far as, they're looked at, as less desirable people or poor, so from that standpoint, they kind of, the Avery's, especially Steve, had a sort of a target on his back. So it's kind of manifested and kind of grown over the years, and part of it then over time becomes just to save face. I mean, it was just so embarrassing and humiliating for these people that ran the sheriff's department, that thought they were above everybody in town, to be embarrassed by the fact that Steve Avery gets let out of prison, then now he's doing lots of media interviews and he's getting wined and dined by some of the state politicians who were trying to do some criminal justice reform at that point in time in 2003 to 2005. And it just had to be infuriating. And the fact that his lawsuit was moving forward and having success, not only would that have meant Steve Avery would have been rich and had a lot of money, probably had more money than anybody around Manitowoc County for that matter. But then, there's probably going to be some fallout from that, which means that somebody's going to run for sheriff. Some of these people are going to get cleaned out of their jobs and stuff like that. So their livelihoods, were also at stake as well, as far as if Steve Avery was, exonerated and, was allowed to, remain a key, part of the community and stuff like that. And a place like Chicago or, major city like Milwaukee, I don't know if people would have cared as much, but in a small town like this, these guys do hold grudges and a guy like Steve Avery would be, kind of have a target on his back. Just because I know that I saw that when I was out in Nebraska, one of my previous books I wrote about where the cops were just so enraged and couldn't believe that they screwed up a case and, arrested the wrong people for it and stuff like that. It just, so they really, they really do hold these things, hold on to these things and don't let them go.
But how does that spread to Brad Schimmel and kind of like you mentioned the judges at the Supreme Court almost doing this on bank review of the case? Where is it creeping out of the county and going into the state and then into the whole nation?
Well, I think at least on the state level, especially from my observations when I saw Brad Schimmel in action on the case, and he just seemed like he was really just a politician that really didn't know very much about the Brendan Dassey case or the Steve Avery case, but was just kind of reading talking points and saying kind of what the police and other, people in his office, told him to say. So it's just one of those things that it's very hard sometimes for these high level politicians or even the judges sometimes to step back and give something a really honest, assessment. I had that years ago out in Nebraska where a judge found a very high powerful CSI director. He found him guilty at a bench trial of planting evidence and stuff like that, planting blood and murder cases. And the defendant in that case, the CSI director, he actually asked for a bench trial rather than a jury trial because he thought, no judge would have the guts to convict him, planting evidence. So it's very rare, but to do the right thing. And I was really proud of that judge because, the trial was really an unbelievable trial. But, yeah, you have these people that all kind of trying to save face, and they're looking at it from a standpoint of, how's Wisconsin's image going to look, if we would let Steve Avery out or Brendan Dassey out or, be in support of their motion or try to work with Kathleen Zellner on the evidence testing. It's there's a lot of states that have set up, I think they're called like integrity commissions or the basically prosecutors that work to make sure that convictions are legitimate and you just don't really see that in Wisconsin. It seems like with this case, with the Avery case, if anything they've done they've kind of doubled down, so to speak, and really are trying to do everything they can to kind of plug the dike so the water, the dam doesn't burst, so to speak, on this case. It's unfortunate, but that's the way it is.
Seems like there's a lot of, perception is reality, and I think that happened kind of before Stephen was actually even convicted for the murder of Teresa Halbach, in that there was so much propaganda and hype going on that he had done it, that by the time he got to court, everybody's opinions were kind of swayed to the fact that, he totally did it, because that's what everybody was saying. And it seems that kind of, a guy like a Brad Schimmel, like you mentioned, or these people that are talking about the case don't even really know the specifics of it. They just know that, of course he's guilty. How can he not be? And then take that kind of mindset before they even know the facts.
Right. And that's definitely seemed to be the case to me. And again, I can only base it on my own life experiences, Chris. And again, a couple of years earlier, I had a similar situation in Nebraska where, a different Republican conservative attorney general at that point in time, he actually set up a state police task force and made sure that the local sheriff's department did not, oversee this reinvestigation of this 1980s murder that was questionable as far as whether six people that went to prison for the crime, were in fact the real culprits or not. And in the end, the attorney general held a press conference and, announced that all six of them, three men and three women, had nothing to do with this crime. And it was somebody else that did the crime. And he explained in great detail who this person was and how they did the crime and how they solved it. And the state of Nebraska eventually gave all six of these people, pardons. And that was technically not the most popular thing to do because, the voting area where this crime happened was mostly Republican conservative, and so were these politicians that were making these decisions. But again, as the attorney general told me, it was more important to get the case right, rather than to, play politics and just kind of, avoid the scary thing that's behind the door and stuff like that, really confronting the reality of this case, I should say.
Well, because to overturn it, there's going to be a lot of people eating crow and a lot of, a lot of lawsuits, like we mentioned. I mean, it's almost like to get true justice, a lot of other people are going to go down now because it's been going on for so long. So there's a lot of people that are going to be protecting their own asses to make sure that justice is never served just so they don't have to, face it.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, because and you can't tell me that in the back of, some of these people's minds that they're not thinking, oh, boy, if we let Brendan Dassey and Steve Avery out of prison now, who are they going to sue and how many, depositions are they going to have to, give, and then what lawyers are going to get brought in, and then the publicity we're going to get, and then maybe there's another Making a Murderer Part 3, and the New York Times will come in town and stuff like that. I mean, those people think about those kinds of things and stuff like that. And I know, especially, just even on the local level, the city of Manitowoc and like their Chamber of Commerce and their tourism people, I mean, they were really trying to get some of the news stations and the newspaper in that town to really kind of back off on doing stories about Making a Murder after it came out, because they just didn't want the stigma or the notoriety of being known, for the Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey case and stuff like that. So you do have this kind of, let's just keep this case, let's not talk about it, let's not reinvestigate it, let's just kind of let it die, and let's forget about these people.
Let's talk about some of the strategies that Catherine Zellner is employing. Tell us a little bit what she's doing to kind of prove the innocence of Stephen Avery.
Well, she's taken a unique approach from the standpoint that you have so many different pieces of really strange, and odd forensic evidence that really came up, that was used against him at the most opportune times. And what she's done, Chris, is she's gone out and hired some of the cream of the crop, the best of the best as far as people that are really specialized and world-renowned experts in different areas of forensic science.
And this is at her own expense, right? Because she's doing this all pro bono.
Yeah, good point. Stress it. Yeah, this isn't money that the state of Wisconsin taxpayers are paying or anything like that. This is all, all money, again, that she's spending out of her own, law firm's budget or bank account, so to speak. And she's met with people that are just unbelievable experts. There's one actually down in Florida, Fort Lauderdale, Stuart James, who's really a world-renowned blood spatter expert, and he plays a huge role in this case as far as the reinvestigation of the Teresa Halbach murder, where he's come up with scientific evidence to show that how and where Teresa Halbach was probably killed, which would have been outside of her vehicle, with the RAV4, the back door, the whatever you call that, the hood. Is that right?
The hatch or whatever.
The trunk hatch lifted open at the time. So just some really unbelievable experiments that these people have done. And then, so you go from Stuart James in Florida to a guy named Luke Haig, who's out in the Phoenix, Arizona area, who's just a really prolific ballistic gun expert. And they did numerous experiments as far as on the firing from different ranges to see whether it was possible that you could actually fire a bullet through somebody's skull and not have skull fragments, left on the bullet, which is what happened in the Teresa Halbach case, and then there's other experts that that are just unbelievable as far as being able to use some of the best microscopes around, you know, around the world, and they were able to really study the bullet that was found in Steve Avery's garage, the one that was portrayed and represented as being a bullet that had passed through Teresa Halbach's skull, you know, that she supposedly, you know, was fatally shot inside this cluttered garage of Steve Avery. And these individuals have done all kinds of experiments, you know, putting this bullet under the microscope, and they found, you know, wood particles, not brain fragments or brain matter, but wood particles on this bullet, which raises the strong possibility that this bullet just was pulled out of the garage because, you know, before Steve Avery lived there, there was a guy that would just hunt, you know, varmints and critters all the time and just, you know, fire left and right, you know, at the garage and stuff like that. It's a junkyard, for God's sake. So, but anyway, so she's just really taken apart. And there's another half a dozen other different examples, but she's just really focused with a kind of a laser focus, but she's just really zeroed in on individual pieces of evidence and just how they were misrepresented or, you know, or were incorrectly presented at trial, that they absolutely have nothing to do with Steve Avery's, you know, guilt, and that these were pieces of evidence that were, you know, forged or, you know, fabricated, you know, by the police and the prosecutor, according to Zellner.
Yeah, evidence that was planted as well.
Yeah.
Because that's part of it, too, when you watch the show and read the book, just how much of this evidence, you know, that they would go searching through a vehicle and then go search through it again 3 days later and suddenly, oh, wow, there's blood flecks and now there's, you know, there's a bullet, there's license plates in the back of a smashed window vehicle on, you know, this junkyard that the Averys had.
Right, right.
You know, there's so many of those things. And it blows my mind that they were able to get away with all of these things and that a lot of it never even came into discussion at the original trial.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. You said it right there, Chris. You said that they were able to get away with, and that's the key component right there, because it just blows you away, especially, and I know that's one of the most overlooked pieces of evidence in the case, because there are so many different pieces of evidence, and, you know, and obviously I, you know, like a lot of people, was really fascinated by that whole peculiar discovery of the spare key, the one that showed up on, you know, on the bedroom floor, you know, on the, you know, sixth or seventh time that Colburn and Lank were in there. But the license plates, you know, are also one of the most interesting items that somehow surface in the case. And several days later, and, you know, and again, just from the timeline standpoint, you had like 200 police officers and volunteer firefighters that were brought in on Sunday, November 6th, which was just, for people, that's the day after the vehicle was found on the outer edge of the RAV4. Teresa Halbach's vehicle was found on the outer edge of the Steve Avery property. So you have a couple of hundred, you know, police and firefighters searched they canvassed the entire junkyard with 4,000 vehicles or so the very next day, and don't find anything of any value as far as evidentiary value is concerned. And then you're going to have the next day, you're going to have a couple of these Manitowoc County Sheriff's officials supposedly being sent to, you know, kind of wander around the junkyard for a few hours to, you know, to make sure that every vehicle was, you know, was gotten to. And then what are you going to do? You know, you're going to bring everybody back, you know, a couple hundred people back again the following day. And then lo and behold, the, you know, crumbled license plates turn up inside of a junked station wagon that's got no windows on it. So, I mean, just that in and of itself, Chris, you know, just stinks to high heaven and just really looks like this thing was all staged, you know, because again, if you're going to go to that length to bring in a couple, you know, 100 people, why would you even think that they screwed up or were so lazy or incompetent that all of a sudden you're going to need them, you know, back? And if you did really feel that way, then why wouldn't you have brought them back the very next day? Why would you spread it out and do it on Sunday, skip Monday, and then come back on Tuesday, you know? Right.
When you were talking about the spare key from Teresa's SUV that was found in Avery's house that wasn't there originally, all of these things. Now, there's something that you wrote in your book that I thought was really interesting. You said the only way that three people can keep a secret is if two of them are dead. an old pirate or an old gangster saying. So if this is the case and there's, you know, a whole battalion of police in Manawatu County that are in on this, how are they all staying completely true and silent about it?
Either they're all complicit, you know, in it, or, you know, they also, you know, you have also have to look at the possibility that they may be involved, you know, in evidence planting or, you know, fabrication on lower level, you know, smaller cases that never make it, you know, in the newspapers or in the press and stuff like that. Because, you know, as often happens in a lot of these evidence planting cases, you know, it's the high profile cases, the one that draws our attention. But then you find out years earlier, you know, the individual was involved in, you know, in kind of lower level, you know, stuff. And I had that out in Nebraska, you know, with that CSI director that I talked about, where he was faking, you know, laying fingerprints just to basically, you know, gain a reputation, you know, of being like some gun expert when he really wasn't, stuff like that. And all the cases that he was messing around with, you know, were cases that nobody had ever heard of or, you know, would even care about. But he just did it, you know, for ego. And then once he was already established as this great, you know, gun expert, then he was also going out, you know, in, you know, planting blood, you know, in murder cases to help shore up the police cases and stuff like that. But the fact is, it's very rare. It does happen, but it's very rare that you're going to have somebody, you know, turn on somebody like this. So unless somebody has direct knowledge or, you know, had a conversation with one of these, you know, sheriff officials or police officers from the state of Wisconsin that may have been involved in fabricating evidence or cooking up, you know, stuff at the crime lab. It's unless somebody like that goes to the FBI, you know, that's the only real way that, you know, that they could, you know, do this. Because oftentimes if word gets out that you're going around, you know, trying to work behind the scenes and expose somebody in your own police department, are the people that do disappear. I got a case like that predates me, but goes back to 1990 here in Joliet, Illinois, in Will County, Drew Peterson area, where a female sheriff's deputy disappeared and has never been found. You know, she disappeared in 1990, you know, and, you know, it's just those kinds of things do happen. And especially in an area like Manitowoc County, I mean, believe me, these guys would know that. So unless they have direct knowledge. And the other thing, too, is they're not going to want to rock the boat because, you know, they may all believe that, you know what, Steve Avery, you know, is a bad person. And, you know, Brendan Dassey was going to grow up to be a bad person. I'm not saying I believe this. I'm just saying they probably believe that. So in their minds, for a lot of them, they may believe, well, you know what, Steve Avery didn't do the Teresa. We don't know if he did the Teresa Halbach murder. But you know what, if he's out in society, if he's out in the street, he's going to do something to harm some other woman or beat somebody up or kill them. So he's better off in prison. So that's kind of how a lot of them justify whether there was evidence that was planted or manipulated or staged in this case or other cases. They believe that the person was no good to begin with. And, you know, and if we had to cut some corners, you know, and kind of cheat a little bit, so to speak, you know, the ends justify the means. Yeah. That's really what it boils down to.
When you talk about this planting of evidence, is this something that happens, you know, on a regular basis throughout the country?
It happens frequently. It you know, as far as regular basis, you know, I would say it happens in a, you know, very small percentage of cases, but it does happen. I don't want people to kind of, you know, be naive and think that Steve Avery case may be the only case that some nonsense like this has happened, because that's definitely not the case. It's hard for it to come out as far as for people to learn about it, but it does come out usually if the evidence that's planted, you know, doesn't match up, you know, with the person that was involved in the crime, you know, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And so I have, like I said, I had a case 10 years ago when I was out in Omaha, Nebraska, where a CSI guy goes, he ruins his career and, you know, and eventually went to prison, you know, for planting blood, you know, in at least two different murder cases. I always suspected, and I point out in my book, that he, you know, may have did it in at least a half a dozen other ones, but just where he was, where even people that he worked with started to become suspicious. And it was just like you said, you know, oftentimes he was going back into, you know, into a car, you know, or a house, you know, a second or a third time around. And in one case, there was actually a dumpster, you know, that you know, there was a little boy had disappeared, and you know, the belief was that his deranged father had committed the crime, which was true. But again, to shore up the case, because the little boy's body was never found, the CSI investigator came up with a claim that he found some blood in this outside dumpster, you know, 5 months after the boy had disappeared. That fact could not have happened that way. And eventually, you know, renowned experts from California came in and testified that no, this dumpster had been dumped 40 some times, you know, between January and June. And plus, it was outside in the weather. It was raining all the time. It was snowing all the time. You know, you would not have been able to get a perfect, you know, pristine DNA sample, you know, from the bottom of the dumpster, like this CSI investigator, you know, had claimed,
right?
You know, when he faked this case.
Let me ask you this, John. Just thinking about Teresa's family, because they're very much involved in making a murder, you know, part one and two. They're always at the trials. They're always in the court. Schimmel's whole MO is every time they ask him about, you know, what's going on, it's like, we just want to bring justice to Teresa's family and bring peace of mind to Teresa's family. If I was in Teresa's family and there's this much controversy over who had done this, I would start wanting to know more as well. Are they at all in your dealings with anybody, with the brothers or the parents? Do they 1,000% still believe it's Avery or Brendan? Are they ever questioning things? What did you find out about that?
I'm of the opinion that they're just kind of, you know, going along with the program and kind right. of always have. They, for the most part, have you know, made the decision to really either avoid being interviewed or give interviews, you know, in these recent years. The other thing I don't know, which does happen a lot of times, is that sometimes, you know, these families become intertwined, you know, with the police investigators on right. the case. And I can tell you from experience, you know, on other cases like this, where sometimes that's when the police kind of really, you know, double down and they really tell these families, you know, we got it right the first time around. This is just some unethical defense attorney that's trying to make a name for himself right. or something like that, when the opposite is really true. But again, if you have an emotional connection between, you know, some of these investigators on this case from the get-go, you know, you're going to stick with them. And so when they tell you that they got it right, you're going to believe them. And because really, you don't have a reason to learn otherwise. But, you know, part of me, though, thinks that they're smart individuals. You know, one of them is an attorney himself. The other one works for the Green Bay Packers. They're good people. And you would think that at some point in time, they step back and reassessed, some of the case, and have to, you know, have a discussion around the family dinner table or something like that, to the effect of, you know, could this really have happened, you know, the way that Ken Krantz and, you know, Manitowoc County told us it did, or is there a possibility that Zellner and Steve Drissen are right? But again, it's really hard to reconcile that, because then you're really reopening the whole case and you're going to have to relive everything. But in reality, that's going to happen anyway, you know. Well, so
it's happening just by the fact that the show was even on the air, I would assume, you know.
Everyone's the worst thing I think anybody could ever want is closure that's incorrect closure, you know. I mean, because that's no good for anybody, you know.
Right.
If the wrong people under the wrong set of facts, you know, are kind of, you know, set in stone, so to speak, you know, then the community and the public, you know, at large, you know, is really underserved, you know, and, you know, the truth needs to come out, whatever it really is.
No, you're right. You're right. And then the question I was going to ask you then, so let's say Avery and Dassey are completely innocent. In your mind, who killed Teresa Halbach?
As far as the alternative suspects, and there are a lot of them, I still go back to the, you know, the strong possibility that, you know, as Zellner has done, you know, look at Bobby Dassey as being a logical, you know, suspect or person of interest, just from the standpoint of some of the peculiar behaviors that he's involved with, Chris, and the fact that you do have Teresa Halbach's bones, you know, or charred bones are found at the bottom, you know, of his burn barrel, and the fact that he was a very proficient, you know, hunter, you know, where he was pretty good at, you know, cutting up, you know, dead animals and really had no fear, you know, or, you know, of doing that was pretty, pretty good at it. So the fact that he also basically puts himself, as far as watching Teresa Halbach at the time that she disappears, that's another red flag in my mind too. As far as he's watching her. I mean, I would argue that he's, he maybe, as Zellner said, he's stalking her, he's watching her, he knows that she's going to show up, on Avery Road for this photo assignment, on her last, what's going to turn out to be her last day of life. And then the fact too, that you have some of these other weird, behaviors by Bobby Dassey in the days after the crime, especially the fact that he goes out and pulls this dead deer carcass off of one of the nearby roads, and strings it up in his garage, around the time that the police are starting to poke around and look around at his uncle, and also just the whole Avery Salvage yard and pretty much all the properties, on Avery Salvage, So just a lot of, weird, strange behaviors. So again, I can't say for sure, but again, I mean, Zellner seems to feel that she's on the right track as far as, really honing in on Bobby Dassey and his stepdad, Scott Tadich, as far as maybe helping out as far as, getting rid of, the dead body and, and concealing it, that kind of stuff. So.
Well, and then plus two, then she found, all this computer evidence of all of the, horrific images that Bobby Dassey was looking for online that was never once again submitted in the initial trial for evidence purposes and all this other stuff. I mean, I actually screenshotted some of the things he was looking up from, 11-year-old sex, girl naked, hot teen pussy, nude teenage girls, drowned girls, car accident, deceased girls. This guy is looking for some pretty crazy, dark stuff, and I
know that Zellner's experts did point out this was repetitive too. So this was kind of like his daily ritual or daily behavior. So it's the exact opposite of Steve Avery, who had a girlfriend and really wasn't, online, or doing any of this stuff as far as looking up, this really seedy, violent, pornography and stuff like that, whatever you want to call it. But yeah, this is kind of Bobby Dassey's, lifestyle. And then you get the fact that I think some of those images that you were talking about, resembled, Teresa Halbach or looked very similar to her. And there's also discoveries of like a folder on his computer that had, like a Teresa Halbach one and a Steve Avery one. And I think a DNA, DNA for like DNA, so just, just really bizarre stuff. And another one I just thought of too, Chris, and I point this out in the book a little bit, but when he eventually gets brought in for questioning, they noticed that he had a bunch of scratch marks on his back, and he claimed that his 2 or 3 week old, Labrador, had jumped on him that very morning, and caused those scratches again, Zellner's experts, look at those scratches and, think that those are more likely to have come, from, a woman's, fingernails, who's being attacked and trying to get away, break free from an attack. And, it's just interesting that you don't see Bobby Dassey or Scott Tadich volunteering to sit down, with Kathleen Zellner, and do a tell-all, and tell her, everything to try to clear themselves. And, wouldn't you think that if they had absolutely nothing to do or no involvement at all, they'd be driving down to Chicago, wanting to cooperate with her rather than kind of, going into hiding or not trying to make any statement and stuff like that.
Well, it blows my mind too, that, once again, Ken Kratz, who was the attorney, the word is escaping me, the prosecutor, that he had this evidence of Bobby Dassey's computer habits, but kind of buried it under Brendan Dassey so that no one would take it any further, and then that's blows me away as well. And then the fact, like you said, that now Tadich and Bobby Dassey have been, accused via Making a Murderer 2, that they're not going out of their way to clear their good name. They're just ignoring it,
Right. Yeah, and that's a good point you brought up, because that just shows you the you know, how Ken Kratz behaves, you know, and just what kind of guy he is. The fact that, he, you know, went to great lengths to try to conceal, you know, and hide from Jerry Buting and Dean Strang, you know, the obvious fact that, you know, this report had been done and he sat on it for like 7 months and doesn't turn it over to the defense. It was actually done, I think, in May of 2006, but right on the verge of the trial. I think we're in December of 2006 now, you know, writes up a report, gives them like 7 items, but doesn't give them this computer disk, you know, that had actually, you know, all this, this really dark, seedy stuff that I'm sure Jerry Buting and Dean Strang would have been smart enough to, you know, to look at and realize, you know, this bolsters their game. This bolsters their chances to actually put on a defense that could point to somebody else as an alternative suspect. But without that disc, you know, without that report, they didn't know what they didn't know. And again, that falls back on Ken Kratz, you know, and his side, you know, making a conscious decision that, hey, we're not going to give this over to these guys, you know, because, you know, we know if we do, there's a chance that, you know, this could really harm or damage, you know, the case that we're going to go to trial against Brendan Dassey and Steve Avery, in my opinion.
Now, is it, I mean, this is something too, just like if it has, you know, if Scott Tadich, who is Brendan's stepfather, and Bobby Dassey, who's Brendan's brother, if they did do this, how much more diabolical is it that they've let their brother, you know, stepson, rot in jail for 12 years? You know, that to me is the one where it's like, there's no way that they could have done it, because who could allow that, you know, to let your brother just sit there in jail knowing that it was you who really did it?
It's unbelievable. But actually, if you look up, I think if somebody, if you would Google, I think it's just wrongful convictions. And I think the last name is Bledsoe, if I'm not mistaken, but it was, I think it's either out of Kansas or Missouri. And I'm pretty sure it's Kansas, but an exact situation like that happened where an individual went to prison for several years for a murder that was actually committed by his brother. And when the police finally got around to exonerating, you know, the wrongfully convicted guy, and, you know, and we're moving forward. And I think they even got a warrant, you know, for the arrest of the other brother many years later. You know, he killed himself before the police were able to get there. So, but that fact, that did happen. So, I mean, there's situations around the country where the same scenario had happened. And actually, I think there was a case in Wisconsin that it was either Jerry Buting, I think it was, yeah, Buting or Strang had represented a guy with the last name of Armstrong. And he went to prison for many years in Wisconsin for a rape and a murder that was ultimately committed by his brother, who was dead by the time that the case, you know, the true facts of the case were, you know, came out and stuff like that. So, as like you said, as crazy as that sounds, and people can't believe that that would really happen, it has happened, and it's happened, you know, multiple occasions and stuff like that.
So
I don't know how somebody could live with that, but it's happened.
Well, yeah, and that's. You know, as we wind down here, you know, I've seen some of Kathleen's tweets. She's very much on social media, giving her version of the murder timeline about how, you know, once again, that's another thing that Bobby Dassey claimed, that Teresa never left Avery's property. And then we find out she did leave the property. The car was found off the property, then brought back onto the property. I mean, there's so much stuff. The bones, like you mentioned, they're in, you know, Bobby Dassey's burn barrel, and they're in Stephen Dassey's, and all this other stuff. There's so much evidence coming out now. And at the end of Making a Murderer 2, Zellner tries to get a retrial based on new evidentiary findings. It gets turned down, basically rubber stamped by a judge in Manitowoc County or wherever it was. What's the update now? Because I'm sure that series debuted in November, probably filmed till probably, I don't know, April, May. Do we have any more leads, findings at this point in time?
Yeah, there's actually been a couple other developments, too, that are really interesting that definitely deserve people's attention keeping up on. Just in the last few weeks or so, Zellner has partnered up with a gentleman. He's out of Harvard, if I'm not mistaken. He's out of the, you know, East Coast Massachusetts area. And I think 60 Minutes had recently profiled him, but he's become, you know, one of the premier DNA experts in the world now. And he actually was out in California just a few months ago after the wildfires, and was able to basically do some unbelievable, like on the spot, DNA testing that was able to identify, I think, like 80% of the, you know, the burn victims. He was able to, you know, get them identified, and he's been, you know, authorized. He's certified, you know, the FBI and CIA, you know, all the major agencies have, you know, vouched for his work. So he's come on board. Zellner's partnered up with him, and now they're trying to get access to those bones that were found at the quarry. You know, again, those were the bones that were really kind of kept out of the original trial. They were downplayed. Kratz had portrayed them as not even being, you know, human, or you're probably not being human. But nonetheless, Zellner was able to find that not only was that, you know, controversial, you know, pelvic bone still in existence, but there were also two other areas in that quarry, two completely different areas where apparently human bones were found, human bones that have never been identified to this point in history, is, you know, which is pretty damn suspicious, mm-hmm. if you ask me. So she's brought this individual on board. Now they're trying to get, you know, they're waiting for the state of Wisconsin's, you know, response as far as is Wisconsin going to, you know, go along with the program and say, yes, let's get these tested by your new expert. I think it's like last name is Selden, if I'm not mistaken. I'm pretty sure he's on Twitter, but she's even pointed out that she's totally fine and welcomes, you know, anybody from Wisconsin, from the prosecution side, they can be present, you know, and observe, you know, when this guy does do his tests and stuff like that. So it's not going to be, you know, anything that she's trying to do, you know, in the dark, but she wants to be totally transparent, you know, on all this. And again, that would really be huge, don't you think, if somehow we know for a fact that all these bones that were found at the quarry sites, you know, were Teresa Halbach's, because again, it totally, you know, dismantles the prosecution's original theory that somehow, you know, Steve Avery, you know, butchered and, you know, tortured, right, Teresa Halbach in his bedroom, and then she's still barely alive, and he takes her out to his garage and fires a couple, you know, more shots into her head and makes sure she's dead, and then throws her body, you know, in his burning fire on Halloween night with Brendan there. And, you know, and then, oh, by the way, you know, a half a mile away is where Teresa Halbach's, you know, bones, you know, really, you know, turned up. And stuff
right,
like
right, right, right.
So.
And then there's also news now that Andrew Colburn, the one of the sheriffs who completely blew it, if you watch the show, that he's now suing Netflix for defamation of character. And Zellner said it's like an early Christmas present. Explain that.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about that, I mean, and I just watched a few weeks ago, you know, The Innocent Man, which was really well done, the documentary on Netflix that was about the John Grisham book, you know, from a little while ago, and it was really well done. But it is, and they point out in that the prosecutor in The Innocent Man also filed a defamation lawsuit against John Grisham, you know, over The Innocent Man, and it was thrown out. So I mean, it's basically with Colburn, all the Making a Murderer people basically did was repeat, you know, and document what was the original trial. I mean, anybody that has half a brain had already, you know, known that Dean Strang and Jerry Buting, that was their whole case at trial, was that that Colburn and Link, you know, were the suspected, you know, evidence planters on any and all these pieces of evidence. Zellner's backed off that a little bit and says, well, they didn't do everything, but they did some things, but other people were involved in planting other evidence and stuff like that. So I just don't see that case going anywhere. And I have experience. I mean, I took a whole semester in college, you know, on communications law, studied libel and slander and all that stuff. And there's just, I don't want to give them any tips, but just by listening to this, but just that thing's not going to go anywhere. Let's just leave it at that.
What Zellner was saying, though, is that now he has to go back and revisit all these things. And now they can bust him on all his lies, basically, is what she was saying.
Well, yeah, and the Zellner uncovered, which I worked into my book, which I thought was one of those unbelievable discoveries that has happened since Making a Murderer Part 1 came out, and you know, and since Zellner came on board. But that's the fact that she was able to find that individual that came forward, that guy named Kevin Ramlow, mm-hmm. who bumped into Andy Colburn at the Senex gas station. And we know the guy's telling the truth because he said he remembered distinctly seeing that poster.
The wanted,
you know,
poster,
of Tracy. Yeah, and sure enough, there was a poster, and it was one of the first posters that they put up with Teresa Halbach. So there was a couple different versions that were floating around out there, and this guy distinctly remembered seeing it. And again, as Zellner's pointed out, this guy has no dog in the fight whatsoever. You know, I mean, it's the opposite. I mean, he'd be the last person that would want any notoriety or any publicity, but he just kind of, he didn't even watch Make Your Murder when it first came out. It just, it took like a year, year and a half or so before he finally got around or, you know, was thumbing through Netflix and said, oh, maybe I'll watch that, you know? Yeah. But then his conscience got to him and he realized, you know, I got to do something. And I don't know if you remember, but I think that what he actually knew and, you know, was kind of friends with Scott Tadich and, sent him several text messages, you know, after watching Making a Murder, and, you know, and Todd is just kind of ignores him and blows him off, which, yeah, again, is kind of interesting if you think about it, you know, so it just, yeah, I mean, I don't know if Andy Colburn really thought this through, but, you know, if you Google John Farrick and Andy Colburn, or Andrew Colburn, I should say his formal name, you know, it always shows up in Google, but like he had, we did a story, or one of my colleagues did a story. He sent me this long email, you know, basically berating me about a month after Making a Murder came out for some of my stories that I was doing, for USA Today. Yeah, Colburn did. Yeah. He sent me this long, long email. My boss was like, hell, let's run a story on this, and my boss stood up for me, rightfully so, you know, but basically his email was just trying to take me to task, you know, and he was claiming like that we were, you know, printing private information about where Jim Link lived, you know, which is not true. We just said basically he moved to Arizona, is living on a golf course or something like that. But it seemed to me, though, you know, and then he said something at the end, which was really kind of cryptic. He was like, you know, you better watch what you're, you know, wishing for or something like that. He's like, you may have Brendan Dassey, you know, as one of your next door neighbors someday. He's just one of these kind of guys that he just snaps. He's really impulsive, you could tell. I think that he's one of those cops that, you know, everything's black and white to him. And if he was involved, you know, in either planting evidence or helping other people plant evidence, he would be the kind of guy that would justify it in his mind to say, you know, Steve Avery and Brendan Dassey, you know, are just no good people, you know, and, you know, so we right, got to yeah, bend yeah. the rules. That would be the kind of mind frame, you know, that would go on in Andy Colburn's head and stuff like that. So,
yeah. Last question for you, John, with all the research you've done and everything that's going on, do you think that Stephen Avery and Brendan Dassey will be released ever anytime soon?
I think that they will, just because I think that at some point in time that there's going to be, the right people will be in either office or on the judicial, you know, on a bench at some point in time. And just they will step back and realize, you know, do the facts of the case justify a conviction? You know, did they basically, it really boils down to, you know, was the original case, was it fair and just, you know, or, you know, and if you find any, you know, hint of planted evidence or tainted, you know, testimony, then the facts are that they deserve a new trial. So I think that there's a real good chance that, you know, both of them will eventually, be free and, be out. I just couldn't tell you right now, Chris, if it's going to be 3 months from now or whether it might be, you know, 2 to 3 years from now, because again, and I based that on my experience of covering the Brendan Dassey case, whereas, you know, I was sure as day, you know, that Brendan was going to be, you know, set free in November 2016, and he wasn't. And then when he wins his case on the appeal,
yeah,
I was sure as heck he was going to get set free finally then, you know, and the state of Wisconsin's, you know, attorneys blocked it again. So, but now you do have the change, though, that Brad Schimmel and Scott Walker, the governor and the attorney general, who were both just kind of went along with the program, so to speak, and just refused to really even re-examine the Teresa Halbach case. Both of those guys got defeated.
Oh, wow.
In November. Yeah, the election. Now. Yeah. Walker had run for he was one of the last guys that jumped in the 2016 election, for president. And he just I mean, it was too late to the game, but there was a lot of people that thought that he was going to have a good chance to be the Republican nominee for president, but he just kind of waited and waited till there was already like 15 or whatever people already in the primary, and he just was lost. You could just tell that he wasn't ready for the national scene like he thought he was. But yeah, he just really didn't have much to run on, and you know, and I guess so like I said, he just lost to a different guy who had been the state's oversaw Department of Education for Wisconsin. So time will tell, though. I couldn't tell you right now if the new governor and the new attorney general are going to be any different, you know, than Schimmel or Walker. But at least there's hope now that, hey, maybe finally we got some, you know, politicians in office that are willing to do the right thing and may not be, you know, going along with the program and put up such a big fight like Schimmel, you know, and Greg and Scott Walker did.
Well,
so
hopefully there's a turnover, because I'll tell you what, watching Making a Murderer Part 1, it ends on such a downer. Part 2 ends on such a downer. It'd be really great if Part 3 ended with those guys, you know, walking out of jail and being free and being proven that they're innocent, because it's quite the tangled web. Explained very well in your book, The Wrecking Crew. And John, I appreciate this, man. It's a real interesting topic to think about.
Yeah, no, thanks very much, Chris, really for having me on, and again, just for great discussion about the case, because it really is, you know, so unbelievable. And again, you know, we can only learn from history in these kinds of cases, you know, and the hope is that, you know, that there's no more cases similar to this that, you know, that could recur. Absolutely. In our criminal justice system. So.
Absolutely. Well, thanks, John. I appreciate it, man.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chris. You have a good one.
All right, thanks to John Ferrick. The book is called Wrecking Crew, Demolishing the Case Against Stephen Avery. And it's a great read, especially after seeing the second season of Making a Murder on Netflix. You can get the book at Amazon or wherever fine books are sold. Once again, too, don't forget ChrisJerichoCruise.com. Sign up to the mailing list. We will be announcing details on the second wave, part two, coming up very, very soon. Other than that, I'm pretty much off. I got nothing going on. I'm just excited to be relaxing, taking some time off. Big news coming up. Actually, it probably already was announced, but I will talk about that more on Friday. And also, we're going to talk to the biggest WWE superstar right now, the hottest WWE superstar coming up the ranks, talking about Mustafa Ali. He's talking about his meteoric rise to main event status on the main roster very quickly, how it happened, what it's been like so far. He's talking about the 16 years he spent on the indie scene before landing at WWE 205 Live. He's also telling stories about the other gig he had before becoming a full-time wrestler. He was a Chicago police officer. It's a great conversation with Mustafa Ali on Friday. So we'll see you then. We'll talk more about the big announcement. And until then, stay hard, stay hungry, peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy! And go watch Making a Murder if you haven't seen it. It must be seen. Go check it out, enjoy it, and we'll see you on Friday.